Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Maria Naira, Director of Pollution and Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization, in light of the recently released climate change report predicting a far more rapid onset of harm from irreversible global warming. She can speak to how this affects health around the world. Pollution is now the fourth leading cause of death worldwide. Laurie Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Maria Naira on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Maria Naira, Director of the Department of Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization, which seeks to address the root cause of environmental and social threats to global public health. Prior to that, Dr. Naira served as Vice Minister of Health and President of the Spanish Food Safety Agency. She served as a medical coordinator in Honduras and Salvador for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Naira was awarded the Medal of National Order of Merit from the French government for her work in global public health. She earned her medical degree at the University of Oviedo, Spain, and her master's in public health at the Pierre and Marie Curie University in Paris. She received an international diploma in emergency preparedness and crisis management from the University of Geneva. Dr. Naira, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
You know, the World Health Organization held a joint session with the United Nations addressing a report that's garnered quite a bit of attention recently, and that report looked at global data around population health and pollution and concluded that pollution kills more people around the world in a given year than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and TB combined. And I wonder if you could just share with our listeners the scope of this revelation and how pollution is specifically impacting population health and mortality globally. What does the data show?
The figure is dramatic. We have more than 12.6 million deaths occurring every year. And those deaths are caused by environmental risk factors, whether it's air pollution or unsafe water or exposure to certain type of chemicals like pesticides that are not authorized. This is from a report that only 10 years ago, the situation was terrible already. We did a new one 1 year ago. Almost 25% of all global deaths which are associated with this environmental pollution means risk factors coming from our daily environment and risk factors that could be easily removed, which is the message that I would like to give.
Dr. Naira, all of us who work in the service of advancing the health of people and populations are often struck by just the challenge and the weight of the social determinants of health, whether it's poor air or water or food quality, lack of access to decent housing. But really, there's a unifying factor that comes into play whenever we look at population health issues, and that's poverty, right? Poverty is such a common thread. And we'd like to ask you to talk about the connection between poverty, exposure to environmental pollution, and a higher risk for poor health outcomes, and how we can balance the need to promote economic growth while at the same time protecting human health from the harmful effects of pollution.
There is not a surprise to any of us that if you are vulnerable, if you are poor, if you are living in a poor country, you will be more exposed to issues like industrial pollution or the fact that you are missing lack of safe water and sanitation, and you will be more exposed to questions related to climate change and global warming and the basics for your health. Now, it's clear as well that in order to have the economic development that you need to take these people out of poverty, you need to do it in a way that you will not destroy the environment where you are living on. And we see that now, for instance, in China, which was one of the countries that were polluting the most and responsible for massive air pollution that was affecting the lungs of their citizens. Now they realize that you can go for a good and rapid economic development without destroying and polluting the water you drink or the air you breathe. So I think this is the key message. Get people out of poverty. You can do it in a sustainable way. That will be even quicker on the way that you take people out of poverty. They will not be exposed to those incredible risks coming from pollution. We saw children now in many countries in Africa recycling lead from car batteries. That's really bad development, mm-hmm. and this is really polluting the next generation. And I think understanding the role that the socio-economic and environmental determinants of our health plays is a critical one for governments, for citizens, and of course for people working on global health and global healthcare.
Dr. Naira, climate change is also exacting a toll on human health. And this year, we've seen widespread devastation here in North America from back-to-back hurricanes. We've seen deadly wildfires as well, and mudslides have destroyed entire communities in the wake of those devastating fires. So we're getting an uncomfortable dose of climate change reality here. And as you assess climate change around the world, how do you view the growing threat to human health?
For us at the World Health Organization and other scientific organizations, we have plenty of evidence demonstrating that the global warming, I mean, the climate change, is really devastating human health as well. Not only because heat waves and floods and droughts will have a very direct contribution to deaths because they take human lives, but as well because of the situation that they will create, the climatic effects on agriculture, for instance. The rising temperatures is responsible for changing the patterns of rainfall, and therefore we are expecting decreases on crops yields in many developing countries. We will have a major demand of food supplies. We are already seeing problems of malnutrition because of lack of agricultural production caused by this direct or indirect effect of climate change and global warming. Of course, if you have a flood, you will destroy lives, but you will destroy shelter. You will force people to go on migration and displacement. And we see as well that many of the diseases that have been representing until now for us a major challenge, like malaria or dengue, I mean, all of those diseases transmitted by vectors, by mosquitoes, they are finding now perfect conditions to spread because we can see even malaria in places in Nairobi where we didn't see it before because it was a mountain, so the mosquitoes will not have the conditions to grow and to transmit. And now they are finding perfect conditions for that. So there are many ways in which our health will be affected by climate change, and it's already occurring. And it's not just a question of developing countries. I think we are all witness now of what major heat waves or extreme weather mm-hmm. events can mm-hmm. bring to our health, the destruction of the basis of our life, like access to food, water, shelter. And if those are destroyed, obviously our health will be very much affected and is already at risk.
Well, Dr. Naira, while climate change poses, as you have just laid out in very clear detail, a huge risk to global health, you have also written about climate change as an opportunity for public health. In a report back in 2014, you outlined a number of ways in which you could make the case that climate change is serving as a catalyst for collaboration, badly needed collaboration, among most countries in the world. Can you talk about your recommendations for battling climate change and where you see the seam of opportunity as all these global entities come together and join forces to battle the causes of climate change?
Yeah, in fact, when I attended all of those big meetings, the summits on climate change, you see that the countries are negotiating and putting together this Paris Treaty on climate change. When you look at the recommendations to tackle the causes of climate change, to mitigate climate change, there are all basic public health common sense recommendations, means ensuring that the way we commute with every day, I mean, the way we use our transport and the fuels we are using that shouldn't be polluting our environment, and all of that will end in our lungs, and that pollution is really having a terrible impact on our health. So who will disagree with the fact that we need to create cities where the air is not so polluted, where traffic and transit will be causing less injuries and promoting a little bit more active lifestyle instead of just a sedentary lifestyle that is responsible for non-communicable diseases? Who will disagree on the need to have access to clean water and protect our resources on water management? Who will disagree with the need to have a better management of our waste, the incredible amount of waste that we all produce every day? Who will disagree with the need of non-contaminate our rivers and the land that, where we produce agriculture? So all of that is really basic public health and is basic common sense recommendations for protecting our environment, but more importantly, for protecting our health. That's why we said that this is a public health opportunity. If the Paris Treaty Agreement is implemented, this is a fantastic public health opportunity because all of those recommendations will be protecting the health of our citizens, of our population, and this is fantastic. And this is something that we were not saying clearly enough to our citizens. They thought that the climate change was more a question of polar bears and glaciers melting. No, this is a question of our lungs, the fact that our grandchild will have asthma, the fact that we cannot drink water that is not responsible for diarrheal diseases and other infections. So if we start to use the health argument, I think we can achieve much more by telling people of the importance of protecting and reducing environmental risk in order to protect our health.
We're speaking today with Dr. Maria Neira, Director of the Department of Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization, which seeks to address the root cause of environmental and social threats to global public health. You know, Dr. Neira, you've been connecting the dots on pollution and non-communicable diseases caused by environmental factors, but we still face a huge health burden of disease with illnesses such as HIV, AIDS, malaria, and emerging pandemics like Ebola and Zika. And many global health entities, including the World Health Organization, were caught by surprise during the terrible Ebola epidemic, which led to thousands of deaths. Share with us lessons learned from the Ebola and Zika crisis and the new emergency risk communication guidelines developed by the World Health Organization. Is the global health community better prepared for the next pandemic?
I want to think that, yes, we are better prepared. The governments after the Ebola outbreak, which was so terrifying for all of us and probably as well a kind of shaking us, demonstrating that we are not alone. We are all in the same boat and it's extremely important. So WHO has now a very strong and separate health emergency program to coordinate the international health response to affected people. For instance, this year, we receive an incredible amount for investigation on what are the disease alerts. WHO has already received 36,000 disease alerts. But regarding communication, I think it's extremely important for the people. They need to know what health risks they face. And not only that, I think we cannot paralyze our audience just by telling them what are the risks they face. They need to know what actions they can take to protect their lives, their health, their families, their communities. So that's why the acute and very accurate information needs to be provided and in a way that will enable people to make their own choices and to protect themselves. And we work with partners to support that training, and we will be launching this first ever evidence-based guidance on emergency risk communication.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Nehra, I'd like to talk a little bit about HIV/AIDS, a disease that still has no vaccine and no cure. Millions have died. 37 million people are living with HIV/AIDS around the world, and still so many unaware that they are affected. It's been wonderful to witness the tremendous progress in treating HIV, particularly early on with retroviral drugs. And obviously, we've made enormous strides in reducing mother-to-child transmission. What is hopeful on the horizon?
The good thing is that, and believe me, this is something that we will never dream about many years ago when we started with antiretroviral treatment. Today, we have 21 million people with HIV, with access to HIV treatment. That's really amazing compared with the fact that when we started and we wanted to reach 3 million, everybody was saying, this is totally crazy. Today, 7 out of 10 pregnant women are living with HIV, but they receive antiretroviral treatment to prevent transmission to their babies. And since 2000, I think HIV-related deaths have went down by one-third, and new infections have reduced by 40%. Is more progress needed? And once again, related to poverty, Africa is still by far the region with the highest number of people living with HIV worldwide, which is unacceptable because we know that there are an estimated 7% of people which are living with HIV and they don't know their status, so means more transmissions. So we need to improve access to testing services, increase education, and clearly still promote on education. And the big worry here is about drug resistance. That will undermine the fantastic progress that has been done.
Dr. Nehra, we've had the opportunity to interview a number of leaders of organizations doing great work like yourself, Doctors Without Borders, AmeriCares, and Save the Children, all addressing everything from war zones to refugee crisis to the loss of childhood for millions of children. And as you look to the future and the ongoing collaboration with the United Nations, what do you see as the best pathways to overcome many of these global health challenges?
We have so many global health challenges, but definitely, apart from the infectious diseases that we have been talking on HIV, malaria, and TB, making sure that our cities, our urban development is such that will not put our health at risk. The cities are the places where now in 20 years, 70% of the population will be living in urban areas. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that those urban areas are not places where people will have the best conditions to die or to be sick. Mm-hmm. But on the contrary, it has to be a healthy environment. And therefore, we need to look at a sustainable transport system. We need to look at a better way of handling and managing our waste production, better energy for the buildings, energy efficient, non-polluting fuels, industrial production that will not affect the pollution in the places where we live. That is a big challenge, together with the non-communicable diseases. I think environmental health and non-communicable diseases are the big challenges we are facing, and we need to connect all of those agendas, sustainable development, environment, climate change, and health.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Maria Nehra, Director of the Department of Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization. You can learn more about their work by going to WHO.org or follow them on Twitter at WHO or at Dr. Maria Nehra, and that's N-E-I-R-A. Dr. Nehra, we thank you for the work that you do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The midterm elections are less than a month away, and we are seeing ads on healthcare in several races. For instance, in the Tennessee Senate race, A Democratic ad from the group Majority Forward spins the facts in claiming that Representative Marsha Blackburn voted, quote, to give members of Congress health care for life. In fact, lawmakers already had received a health insurance retirement benefit before the 2012 vote in question. There was a possibility at the time that lawmakers could have lost the benefit, but that never happened. The vote was actually to repeal the Affordable Care Act. When the health care legislation was being debated, an amendment by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley was added to require that members of Congress and their staffs get insurance coverage through the ACA's exchanges, as opposed to lawmakers continuing to get insurance through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. The idea behind Grassley's amendment was that if the exchanges were good enough for other Americans, they should be good enough for Congress. Federal employees can keep their health care coverage once they retire, provided they are eligible to retire and had at least 5 years of FEHB coverage immediately before retirement or coverage for the entire period of their service. But once the ACA was enacted in 2010, it required members of Congress to eventually move to the ACA exchanges, which held the first open enrollment period in late 2013, it looked like lawmakers would lose their health insurance retirement benefit. So when House Republicans voted to repeal the law in 2012, Democrats made the argument that the vote would reinstate the benefit for Congress. A few months before the ACA exchange coverage would take effect, the Office of Personnel Management issued a final rule saying that lawmakers and their staff would still be eligible to join the Federal Health Benefits Program in retirement, provided they had 5 years of continuous coverage through either the FEHB or the ACA exchanges. The ad doesn't mention that eligible lawmakers had this so-called health care for life benefit before the ACA, and they still have it today. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the roughly 4 million women who give birth annually in the United States, a quarter of them retain at least 10 pounds gained during their pregnancy. Those numbers go up significantly for African American, Hispanic, and low-income women.
Something about weight retention during this period after having a baby that increases lifetime risk of health problems, cardiovascular disease, and metabolic problems. So I was interested in finding a way to help women during this time, because regardless of how much a woman gains during pregnancy, weight gain during this period is a kind of independent risk factor, we call it.
California Polytechnic Institute researcher Dr. Suzanne Phelan wondered if a customized intervention designed around the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women as well as the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program might help such women shed postpartum weight.
You see about 30% dropout, and it's no surprise because women during the postpartum period, they're busy with their baby, they've got this erratic, unpredictable schedule, or it's really hard to engage in our standard traditional face-to-face interventions. So our team got together and we thought, you know, let's try something online.
Her team designed a website with features such as weekly lessons, a web diary, instructional videos, computerized feedback, text messages, and monthly face-to-face groups at the WIC clinics. 12 clinics were randomized to the WIC program, or the standard care group, or the WIC program plus, the 12-month primarily internet-based weight loss program.
Yeah, so the intervention targeted healthy eating and physical activity and then behavioral strategies. And so we provided some menu plans online that the women could access and use that would promote modest weight loss. And we gave them calorie goals dependent on if they were breastfeeding or not. And we also gave them physical activity goals, and which were 30 minutes most days of the week. And we gave behavioral tools, too, including we promoted self-monitoring, daily recording of their their food intake, which they could do online, or we said they could do, you know, even writing on a napkin.
And the results were significant. More women with the internet intervention, 57%, lost weight than the WIC participants alone, 36%.
Not only that, we got weight loss, and we got a greater proportion of women who lost the 5% and 10% of their body weight, which we know are clinically significant, and they reduced their waist circumference, which is a health indicator for long-term health risk. But the women retain weight differentially around the waist. So it was exciting that we prevented that and even reduced waist circumference in this intervention.
Dr. Phelan says that even though the weight loss amount seems relatively small, about 7 pounds on average, the loss translates into a statistically lower risk of later weight gain and the long-term risk for related health issues such as diabetes and heart disease that accompany it.
But the other key finding is we got a greater percentage of women return to their pre-pregnancy weight. And that is a goal. Even though many of these women were overweight or obese before their pregnancy, the fact that we got them back to their pre-pregnancy weight is really exciting because that does appear to be where the risk is. If you retain weight above pre-pregnancy, that's the risk factor for long-term health problems. So we were excited to increase the number of women who got back to their pre-pregnancy weight.
A low-cost, guided online nutrition and weight loss support program designed for women receiving SNAP and WIC benefits for postpartum nutrition, empowering them with additional tools to lose that nagging baby weight so many women struggle with, and yielding a greater weight loss success and healthier outcomes. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.